This is KMUW, Wichita Public Radio. Engage ICT, Democracy on Tap is a community engagement event series of KMUW Wichita. The following event took place on September 13th at the KMUW studios.
Welcome to our first Engage ICT, Democracy on Tap in-house. And we're glad to have you all here. We know that this is hopefully an interesting and fun subject to talk about. We needed something light. We have a lot going on right now, so we have some folks in the room right behind you who are training to use the computers to be phone volunteers for our pledge drive that's coming up. That starts next Friday, she said. Hint, hint.
She said.
The phone number is... Just kidding. We are going to talk to you this evening in sort of a radio lab style. I don't know if you're familiar with the show, but it's more really just a conversation about being curious. So I'm Deborah Frazier. I'm the general manager here at KMUW.
And I'm Zach Gingrich Gaylord, and I do community fundraising, and I write about hip-hop, among other things.
He looks the part. Well, like I said, we're going to talk about curiosity tonight. So we actually are going to try to address one very simple question of how on earth do we make young people in Wichita become lifelong learners? How do we do that? So hopefully you guys are going to be able to help us with that. But first.
Yeah, so there's a couple of disclaimers that we'd like to go ahead and get out. The first is we've got representatives from USD 259, from the Northfield School, from Wichita Montessori. We'll get into kind of what those things mean. But one really fun part of tonight is going to be exploring the ecology of education in Wichita. And we all know lots of beautiful people who have come from lots of different ways of being educated. And so we're going to respect all those different ways. Some of them went to private school, public school. Some of them went to no school. And we're going to remember those people as we listen to this conversation. And the second one, I heard this little phrase, and I really like it. Not everything that counts can be counted. And we're going to talk a lot about things that count that also can't be counted. Sometimes we'll talk about things that are more quantitative and analytical, but a lot of this is stories and experiences and things that we're very excited about, and I think that'll be fun too. So those are kind of going in our two rules, basically, if you can call them those.
So can we get you to introduce yourselves just briefly? Just let us know who you are,
Okay.
What you're doing here.
All right. First off, my name is Linda Amos, and I'm the head of the Wichita Montessori School. Do you want the whole thing that we're just kind of go through it. Like you said we were
which
doing?
Which means?
Let's do. Tell us a little bit about that.
All right. My name is Linda Amos, and I'm the head of the Wichita Montessori School. I really have felt honored to be on this panel, and I kind of question the innovative things, but I am also thinking of some very wonderful things about this, too. I hope to bring actually a little variety to the discussions. I have a master's degree in education specializing in student personnel and guidance counseling from Wichita State University and an international Montessori diploma from the North American Montessori Center. I've been in the educational field for a long time, and I have been a private tutor, a teacher, a counselor, a life coach, a science lab instructor, leadership guide, Math Olympics instructor, and also the head of the school. I've taught in the public and the private schools here in Wichita, in Greece, New York, Denver, Colorado, and now I'm back to Wichita again. This is my seventh year of being at the Wichita Montessori School, and prior to that, I was at the independent school for 18 years as a teacher and counselor. In fact, our Montessori school is located on the campus of the independent school at 8311 East Douglas. Wichita Montessori was incorporated in 1985, and it was a dream come to life. It was initiated by committed parents who engaged Mrs. Karen Combs to lead this new school. Wichita Montessori was invited then by Willard and Jean Garvey to share the space on the campus at the Independent School, where we have rented space from them for over 30 years. We are our own separate entity, though. For 25 years, Mrs. Combs served as the administrator for the school until she retired in 2011. Since then, I have had this privilege. At Wichita Montessori, I'm the head of the school, but I also team teach third-year students, co-teach science lab, and lead leadership classes. Let me give you a little more information regarding Wichita Montessori philosophy, if some of you aren't familiar with this. The best way for me to tell you about this is to tell you a little bit about who first started this educational approach. Dr. Maria Montessori was a unique individual. Today, the news media would describe her as a person who thinks outside the box, definitely an innovator at her time. She was a pioneer in enabling children to learn about meaningful experiences. Maria Montessori became an Italian doctor in the late 1800s, at a time when most women did not pursue careers. She was fascinated with the attempts to educate developmentally challenged children, and quickly became a leading sought-after authority in this field. Using the sensory-based approach to education, Dr. Montessori opened a school for challenged children. So successful was she within this, that this approach, that she was able to enter these children into mainstream public schools. It was Dr. Montessori's belief that each child came naturally equipped with what is called the absorbent mind. Her findings showed that allowing students some latitude in directing their studies, it resulted in them having a higher motivation and a greater success. Rather than grilling students to memorize facts, which she felt that most of the times those were forgotten, she argued the creation of an environment that they should surround the students should be true learning. Dr. Montessori stated that the secret to good teaching is to regard the child's intelligence as a fertile field, with the seeds being thrown and it to be a flaming area of imagination. Dr. Montessori led a long and an active life that included authoring 25 books on her educational principles, extensive travel, and as well as training lots of educators. For over 30 years, we at the Wichita Montessori School have been a respected school in the community. It's grounded in this Montessori philosophy.
Great.
Okay.
Cool. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. You stopped me. I wasn't quite finished.
Forget that. We'll move on to this.
We're going
to
keep going. Later. All right.
Yeah,
good.
Kathleen.
Kathleen Baston. I teach at Coleman Middle School. I've been with USD 259 for 13 years now and absolutely love what I do. I still get butterflies every school year, and I'm excited about teaching. I teach 6th grade science and 8th grade AVID, which is a college and career readiness program here in Wichita, so very proud of that. I'm a product of 259. I went to Wichita Public Schools my whole life, graduated from WSU with an undergraduate, and then at Friends University with my master's in curriculum and instruction. So I feel like Linda, very honored that I was asked to come, so thank you.
Becky.
I love this because the school where I started, it was called the Rankin School. It was behind Coleman Junior High at 7000 Livonia when it was all fields. The Garvey family started the school with us. Mrs. Rankin gave the school to 20 parents, 10 families. I grew up doing the things that you're doing now, and the basic reason I'm here is because Zach and I had so much fun talking about how to advertise Northfield on KMUW for a while, and I finally had to say it costs too much money because I've just got to be so cheap. that my costs are my introduction. Education is human. It does not need to cost so much. Innovation in education is driving us back to that fact. Northfield School of the Liberal Arts was born out of a great educational legacy. As a family, we started Wichita Collegiate School in 1959. At a certain point, it was my turn. I was the first K through 12 at Collegiate School. I went off to an Episcopal college and then on into paralegal school, married and had 8 kids. It was my turn to take kids back to collegiate school. My dad was the chairman of the board. He called and he said, I have your place ready. I said, Dad, I'm not coming. I have kids at home. I know what to do. I'm going to do it. It costs too much. And it broke his heart, but I went right on into homeschooling. And then at a certain time, it became a desire to start another school. And Northfield School was started in Love Box Company in 1993. We stayed there as citizens of the factory for a long time. Love Box sold in 2006, and we were amicably evicted. And when we left, I said, what do I want the school to become now? And I said, I want it to become a challenge. So we moved right next door to Friends University, and that's where we are now. And you can call me the Amica Schola, which is my Latin title. You can call me the head of school, which is my administrative title. Or you can call me the mistress, whichever you want.
Great. Thanks, Becky. Allison. Go ahead.
Good evening. I just started my 21st year of teaching art. I am currently at Riverside Leadership Magnet Elementary School. Prior to that, I was at West High School teaching graphic design for 13 years. Before that, I was up north of Topeka at a little school called Jackson Heights, where I was the K-12 art teacher. And before that, my very first teaching job was way out in western Kansas in Maxville, and I was also the K-12 art teacher there. I brought kind of a new approach to teaching art to the district about 10 years ago, and so I'm really excited to be able to talk about that a little bit with you all tonight.
Cool. Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you. And then we need to get Zach's disclaimer out of the way.
I'm the king
more
of
disclaimers.
Tonight.
Yeah.
Caveat.
Actually, I have full disclosures here, so the first is that my daughter actually takes art from Allison at Riverside, and she's amazing, so I have a vested interest and bias in Riverside Elementary. I attended Alpha Montessori School from age 3 to 12 and still dream about it every single night. So I've got a vested interest in Montessori. Becky and I had a fascinating conversation, like she said, and actually one of my good friends and neighbors in Riverside neighborhood sent his daughter to Northfield. So I have a vested interest in that as a neighbor and a participant in that community. And Coleman, you wouldn't think that I could have some kind of connection to everything, but a guy who I play chess with is a first-year science teacher at Coleman, and we're just thrilled.
He's doing great.
Yeah, he's doing great. We're thrilled to have him there.
We need a director for our chess club. Are you available?
We'll talk.
Okay,
yeah,
I'm going to.
That's great. Yeah, so I'm biased towards everything here.
Good.
Yeah. Welcome to Wichita.
Yeah.
This is 6 degrees towards Zach.
Yeah.
Okay. You wanna start with Kathleen?
Sure. Okay. So, you know, the part of the topic was innovation in education, but we didn't really know what that meant when we thought about it. And the more we thought about it, we thought, well, let's just find out what is going on, and we have passionate people here. Let's find out what they're passionate about. One way to get at that is to talk about what happened in your first years of teaching. What was it like back then to teach science? Now, I don't mean back then. Like, I assume that there were basic modern interventions in 2004, right, mm-hmm. was your first year. So, but, of course, Facebook wasn't around.
Right.
Twitter wasn't around.
Yes.
iPhones weren't around.
Yes.
There was probably a certain unmediated experience with students back then that doesn't isn't quite the same now. So what was teaching science like in 2004?
It's much different than it is now. We didn't have the technology back then. It was more rote memorization, procedures, those types of things, only dreaming of the technology that we have now. And so it's been interesting. It's been fun. We've had to come up with new, I guess I could say, procedures, protocols with the use of that technology. Sometimes it's a value in the classroom. Sometimes it can be a distraction. With all of the social media, we've had to have conversations of what's appropriate, what's not appropriate. In the science classroom, because technology is changing so fast, funding can be an issue to keep up with that technology. And so we don't always get to be where, I guess, technology is right now. It's just very difficult. But it's tough. It's tough to have that balance of what the students need, what they want, what to get them prepared for. But back in the day, it just wasn't there. You only dreamed of it. You wrote a lot of grants hoping people would give money to get what you needed. And so it has changed. The desire for students to want to learn is much faster. They want almost instant gratification. And I didn't see that back then. They were more patient, they could wait, and now it's almost they wanna know the next step. They wanna know what's going on. They're not satisfied, and sometimes it seems like, I don't wanna say a show you put on for them, but you have to keep them engaged and going at all times. There's no downtime anymore. When before, you could kind of pause, talk about it, get a little deeper, and now we're just constantly do. So I feel like that's kind of the difference, because technology can be a blessing, it could be a curse too in the classroom at times.
Well, I wonder, Allison, art is a contemplative activity that sort of demands reflection and patience and a lack of instant gratification. Is that sort of the same feeling over the course of your tenure? Have kids accelerated in that way?
Yes, and I think that's why I sort of went searching for a new way of doing it. I was at a point at West High School where I felt like I was spending so much time on that engagement piece, and I was losing them, and so I just, you know, I was kind of at the point where either I need to do it differently or I need to be doing something different. And so, so I kind of researched and found a methodology called Teaching for Autistic Behavior, known as TAB. And the level of engagement has increased exponentially because of their ability to choose. They're driving their education within my space now.
Would you call that more Montessori life?
Right, yeah, that's...
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's being done across the board in all sorts of schooling, so...
So, well, I mean, we might as well get a little bit into just briefly that kind of the structure. That does sound rather Montessori. Mm-hmm. So what about letting kids drive themselves?
Well, that is one of the philosophies that Dr. Montessori has that we have incorporated too, because we have found that when children have more of a part of their education, that they become more, their concentration is better, there is this love of learning that happens so much there because they get to choose some. Now, we still have curriculum. We still have different types of things that we want to make sure that they're able to learn. But we also like to go outwards with it, you know, and to be able to expand on things and follow up on things that happen in the world. And so, yes, it is one of those parts of having it where, you know, there is more of a dedication there. There is more of a love. You know, I talked with third-year students today, and I said, what do you really love about this school? And it was fascinating as they were going through, because it was so much that they could see that they could do so many things now compared to if they had been in a different environment. So, you know, there is that part. You're absolutely correct.
Becky, in your environment, how do you define innovation?
Ever ancient, ever new. There are things about being human, and there are things about learning that they just don't change. It was mentioned up here, and I like to tell my students when they show up at the school, yes, there are teachers, and yes, you are students, but oh, by the way, you have your faculty in your sensory perception, and you have your curriculum in the world around you. And the cost of using your faculty on that curriculum is zip. And that's what we're about to do. Now, Northfield School costs money, but we are the lowest tuition, private school tuition in town for a really good reason. We don't have any sports. We don't have any music. We have clubs. We have clubs. We run with the Friends University track, cross-country team and track team. We have cooperated as much as we can with all the existing facilities in Wichita, so we don't have an art program. We go to the art museum. We have the art museum come to us. We have clubs in which parents work. The whole concept of education has to go back to being human. Our motto at Northfield for the last 25 years, we're going to graduate our 25th class, is Nescantur in Admiratione, obviously. You know, we do a little Latin. But Nescantur in Admiratione means let it be born in wonder. It's what we're built to do. And I take my cue from the superintendent of the Los Angeles school system, who 2 years ago said that he graduated fewer people than he sent to jail. He said the size of the building has got to change. I think that where I live, on the last paved road in Sedgwick County, 101st Street North, Grant Township, there used to be 8 schools in the Grant Township. 1939 was the Unified School District Act, which consolidated schools. I would like to see 100 schools like Northfield. I don't want to get any bigger. I want more small schools. I want teachers wherever they are. I want them to make the schools, and I want them to be rewarded for that initiative and any innovation that I want to see teachers making small schools.
Well, to talk about the human aspect of it, I know I mentor student teachers, whether it's their first semester in their methods class to their core four, where they're actually taking over the classroom and teaching. And what I tell them all the time is that they're not going to necessarily remember what you taught them. Mm-hmm. They will remember how you made them feel. And so when to build lifelong learners, I strongly believe that you have to make that personal connection with your students for them to be motivated to learn, to give them some choices in the classroom. With 259, I don't want to say we're boxed in, but we do have standards that we have to follow because of our district guidelines as well as state and federal. But it's that human connection. It's that personal touch that you have with those students. Simply saying hi or asking them, how was your ball game yesterday? And that you're genuine as a teacher. They know that you truly care for them if you take a minute outside the curriculum. And at the middle school level, it's all about skills, building those skills to springboard them into high school. Then, I hate to say it, but then that's when curriculum really matters. They're still learning at the right. middle school level, but it's the skills you're building in them, those personal connections, so they can fall in love with learning, and then they can go into high school and do the curriculum part. But middle school is all about connections. It's all about making them feel seen, important, that they have value. And so that's what I hope I bring to my classroom each day with my students. And then they basically will do anything for me. They will want to learn about the periodic table without fighting me on it. They will want to write those reflective pieces at the end of a lab because, you know, we have that connection. So I totally agree that you have to connect with those students to make learning fun, make it of value, make it innovative. You have to connect with them and their families too. So that's...
Talk about technology, you know, more and more we're getting away from that personal connection. Mm-hmm. And so I think now more than ever, it's important as educators that we are one-on-one, face-to-face, yes. making those connections because mm-hmm. they aren't getting that from the device.
And I
just love that this is just an echo. You ask about passion. People with passion start to say the same things because you're driving yourself towards your desire. I there's a book that being next to Friends University, I've gotten to know the Quakers really, really well. And they have a lot of emphasis on the inner light, that the Quaker way is to allow the inner light to come forward. And a guy named Parker Palmer, one of their most prolific writers in the turn of the century, wrote a book called To Know and To Be Known. And as a faculty, we've gone through that, and it's nothing but, what is the child? Who is this person? Where do they come from? And it takes time. And when you start charging for that time, it's the cost is going to become exorbitant, and it's going to, and the methodology that you're using, whatever it is going to become obsolete. We've got to go back to less cost and more time, one-on-one. At Northfield, we pick up cell phones at the beginning of the year, at the beginning of the day, and we don't allow computers unless a child is diagnosed and has a doctor's.
Technology, it comes up in every conversation on innovation that I could find online, as does the word passion, though, too. I think that's interesting. What do you do with cell phones? What does everybody else do with cell phones? That's my question. Sorry. I'll get to this one. Suddenly I want to know.
Cell phones are tricky, but as far as at our school, it's from three-year-olds to fifth graders. And so we've had some as far as some of our older students have had some medical reasons that they have needed to have that. Or if they go to an after-school company afterwards and they need to call. But it's more with teachers too, mm-hmm. as far as helping, as far as that importance part of being connected and knowing, if there was an emergency, I want the teachers to have it, but it is that balance, and that is something that I think is a difficult thing. I think computers too, for children's studies, as far as the brain development, how we're finding in different studies we've read as far as the 3D images they are not able to develop if they had a lot of, the face-to-face with the flat screens. And so, we've seen that in children sometimes, and that we believe a lot in passion and that calmness. And from the very beginning, our children at 3 years old come in the door and shake hands and eye contact and all those connections. And then with families, having it where the family bonds are so close and our teachers and things. But, that part has come in as far as how do you make sure that when we're working with the children that they always know that we're there with them, and not using the phone because our child is sick at home. And, there is a factor with the cell phones, you're right. But for our children, we don't have that as much.
Mm-hmm. Well, talking about technology, when she said we were moving away from it and in the personal connection, it's interesting that now in my AVID class, which is a college and career readiness mm-hmm. that we have at Coleman, we have to teach those soft skills to our eighth grade students. I just graduated my first eighth grade AVID class. I had them for 3 years.
What does that stand for?
Advancement via individual determination. And so just a real quick synopsis of the program.
Yeah, please.
We target, I'd say target, but we try to reach those students that are in the middle, that might be their first year graduating from high school or the first in the family to go to college. And so we get them, there's a higher expectation of them. We teach them organizational skills. There's different strategies we use for writing, inquiry, organization, and reading. And so it's a really great program. So it's not your perfect student who's an A and B student who has tested high on the standardized test. It's the middle to low end. And they're not always the best well-behaved students either. They can be our most challenging. But we have to teach those soft skills. They don't know. They don't know that you look somebody in the eye because their face is always in their phone. I need you to put your technology away. It's not allowed out until I give you permission to. We do have policies at Coleman about cell phones. 259's policy is that it's supposed to be powered down in your locker, put away. But students will carry it on them. We just don't like to see it out. Every teacher is different. They can use technology in their classroom for music, if that helps them, for other purposes, but the policy really is to put it away before you leave that particular classroom. But we do, that personal connection, the shaking the hand, the looking in the eye, we have to teach our students that now because we've gotten away from that.
And that is such a basis of the Montessori philosophy of how important that whole child is. You know, the academics are very important, but also, you know, the character development, making sure from the very beginning how, you know, respect. You know, in fact, I tell the children, it's only one real rule I have, and it's about respect, and all those things go under the umbrella of respect then. You know, and so teaching them from the beginning and practicing and helping them to see like we do that, you know, it's okay to make mistakes. This is our learning field. This is this opportunity right now where we're going to learn and grow together. So,
and with technology, I feel we have to be careful because if, as a child, they're stimulated all the time, there's no downtime. They are always on at heightened alert, so there's never that calmness. So you asked from my first year of teaching to now, kids are not able to simply sit quiet and listen to a conversation like this. They want to butt in. They want to say something. They want to make a comment. And so we still have to teach them in AVID. Wow. You don't speak while somebody else is speaking. We have to go through manners of how to be a good audience member. You don't interrupt who is speaking. You're focused. We call it slant, that you sit, you looked engaged, you look at the, you know, you can fake it to make it, but you're still going to act like you're listening. So it's interesting that, you know, we want technology and we want them to use it, but then at the same time, we're losing some things as well. But that constant stimulation is not helpful to them.
Well, what we have to acknowledge is that they're developing and that the tool, the fabulous tool that technology can be to accelerate healing in the medical profession, to cause communication. I mean, after what happened in Houston and the Cajun Navy that showed up with an app on their phone, and the city of Houston started coordinating with these people to rescue other people, and so there was this cooperation between public and private. We know that technology is phenomenal. But these children are developing, and I would say 18 is not, we send them off to war, but there's still so much cognitive development, so much convergence that has not yet happened, and we're pushing the limit of their humanity by this stimulation. They need peace and quiet and conversation face to face.
So I want to kind of move and take this idea and ask Allison, what are you doing about that? And it seems like, again, I keep coming back to, boy, if we're going to teach kids to contemplate, art class in an elementary school is like, that's the place, right?
Yeah, it's a gold mine.
So how are kids acting in your class, and what are you doing to help them?
Well, I guess I should start with a little bit of setup for kind of how the room is run. The classroom is no longer called a classroom. It's a studio. The students are not students. They're artists. I am not the teacher. I'm the coach / facilitator. So that's kind of the trifecta there. And so within that space, they are referred to as artists. And the space is broken into 6 different centers based on media. And currently, we have 3 of our centers that are open, but by the 1st of October, all 6 will be open for them. So they're based on media, drawing, painting, clay, fiber, builders, and collage. And so as we open each center, they get basic demo, which is where I hit standards and such, for how materials work in that space, how the materials go back when they're done with them. And then they have full choice as far as what they create in those spaces. What I've found is an empowerment that comes from that sort of situation, where they are driving their learning. They're bringing the ideas to me rather than me standing in front and saying, okay, now everyone cut out the circle and paste it in the corner and now get the yellow, and which is what I've witnessed, what I've seen. And so at any one given time, I am answering authentic questions about weaving and about collaging and about sculpture and about drawing and about how to do a portrait. And it's exhausting, but it's exhausting in such a true way, because I feel like at the end of the day, I've answered questions that really have impacted that particular artist. And it's not so much the battle of engaging them anymore, it's the battle of staying ahead of all those questions and making sure that I am ready for it. We do have computers in the room. They're not open for them yet, but I do have a resource center that they can look up images or they can research things. Like, for instance, I had a fifth grader who wanted to make swords. Fine, but let's get down to how they really make those. And so we studied that and learned about blacksmithing. And of course, we didn't actually do that in the art room, but out of cardboard, we made some pretty nice swords. And they had an understanding of what that was and how it came about and really the artistry behind it. So as far as innovating, because it's not so much technology-based, but it's innovating because it's a flip, it's a switch, instead of now follow me, it's their own interests and their own ideas, their own authentic concepts that are coming to life.
Which just makes that dedication more, and the behavior issues are so much less because of
right
that part
engagement
too.
Is right. Not Absolutely. Engagement's not an issue, and I know that that's an issue at all levels. I mean, I've had conversations with classroom teachers, with my old high school buddies who are still like, 80% of my kids are not engaged in this every day. I don't know how to get them engaged in this. I can't compete with YouTube, and I can't compete with, those apps. And so,
Sounds like the way to engage them is to stop engaging them.
A little bit, yeah. And allow them to choose.
Building on this idea of choice and being human, how it frees us. At Northfield this year, we have a morning convocation, convocare, Latin again, and we bring everybody together, the faculty, the staff, all the students, and we're concentrating this year on the five different ways to take notes. When we all went to school, Roman numeral number one, A, B, small, one, two. We're doing clustering, we're doing drawing, we're asking them to begin to engage. We don't want to force, we have to educare, which is to draw from the student their person and put it with the material. The person has to encounter the material. So I'm just blown away with the number of simultaneous issues that are coming forward here.
And one last thing is, for me, the greatest part of the way my room is set up is I know the kids better than anyone else in the building. I know who's interested in Star Wars. I know who's interested in horses, because that's what they bring to the room every time that I see them. And for me, personally, that's probably the most rewarding thing.
I love that you refer to your students as artists, because in my classroom I refer to them as scientists. We actually did a gumdrop inquiry lab today, and they didn't know it was spice gumdrops. We did all these predictions and everything, and so we talked about food scientists that are out there. How did we get all the flavors of Doritos and potato chips and stuff? So you kind of try and make that connection. You make it relevant but rigorous at the same time. And then they just started asking all these questions. And then it was interesting. I kept calling them scientists. And as scientists, we have to taste the gumdrop in a certain way. We have to smell it a certain way. And everybody did an amazing job. Mm-hmm. And so I just, again, that personal connection. Last year, I really challenged and had questions back to the technology. We had some of the upper eighth grade science classes that were always on the computer. They were doing science on the computer. They were doing the notes on the computer. And I love the virtual labs, don't get me wrong. However, I kept questioning, how is this real science if they are not actually putting their hands on it, actually mixing, pouring, looking at, smelling, touching, seeing all of it, and they're just sitting here doing this for the entire 40 minutes. How is that engaging? And it wasn't. The kids started to push back because they too get tired of the technology. They want that personal connection. They want to put their hands on stuff. They want to get messy and dirty and ask questions. And so I just thought it was neat and called them artists.
Absolutely. Well,
ours are scientists.
Just those tactile experiences.
Yes.
When I was growing up in a Montessori school, there were bottles of different spices that you would smell. There were the frames with cloth with buttons and hooks and things that you would do. There was beads that were arranged in either. In fact, I know my multiplication tables because I had beads that were 10, and then squares that were made of beads that were 100, and then cubes that were made of, and they were 1,000, and those sorts of frameworks, those dimensional frameworks, have really stuck with me more than anything else. And, you know, I actually visited Wichita Montessori and saw all of that same stuff. There's not necessarily innovation in materials in Montessori, but almost like we're talking about this idea of free time, this idea of being driven on your own, facilitated. That's quite an innovation.
Well, and the hands-on that was, you know, started so long ago with her. And, you know, but how important that part is. And that's what we always work on balancing, because we, you know, we're founded on that hands-on education and how important that is for the brain development and everything, and social skills and everything that go with that. And so to have it there, and when we know we want to make sure that our children are prepared for, since we go just to fifth grade, prepared for life beyond Montessori, but also holding true to what we believe is the best benefits for the development of the brain and knowledge and social skills and things like that. So.
And I should mention, actually, now I keep seeing Deborah with one of these, and I don't think we actually mentioned that we've got a lot of notepads, and you can write down questions, and we will attempt to have them answered for you, too. So if you feel so inspired, Alexis is walking around the room, and she'll pick those up from you. Becky, I wanted to ask about your kind of seven principles.
Seven simple rules.
Yeah, you've got the trivium and the quadrivium. Is that right?
Liberal arts are what you do. It's just absolutely what you do to learn. I don't care if you're a car mechanic or you're a history professor. You learn by observation, which is grammar, thinking about it, which is logic, talking about it, which is rhetoric. So the liberal arts are divided into the trivium, grammar, logic, and rhetoric, and it's nothing more than the human dynamic of encountering what's new. You see it, you observe it, you think about it, you talk about it. And it's practiced in the ancient form on the quadrivium, which was the codification of education by the monastic movement in the 12th century, through geometry, which is space, how you make space, arithmetic, which is numbers, which never end, there's always one more, music, which was for them, as the 12th century, a language without words, and then astronomy, which was the most transcendent, the most unreachable. It was the Nescantor and Admiratione. It was the whoa moment.
I'll say. I like that. It all sounds so like.
Well, I think the way I tell the story about Rome falls from greed and its own hubris, and these hordes of barbarians overrun the known world, and these little monks are left with the task of rebuilding the world, and they know better than to try to invent or demand something. They let the world speak, and that's what we're all saying. We are, as teachers, we are letting those students speak. We are letting them become people before we say, now, would you like the challenge of being a scientist, of being an artist, of being an observer? And at Northfield, we say liberal arts scholars. Mm-hmm. We give them an expectation.
We've talked about technology being good and bad. I have a question from the audience about art technology, and you touched on it a bit, but the question is, how has technology affected essentially innovations in the way we teach art, teach art today?
Well, for me, one of the nicest things is that I can do a demonstration with a document camera up on my screen very quickly and easily, and everyone can see it, they're all seeing it the same way. I can record it, so then I can play it back, you know, from the audience then as I'm sitting with groups of kids. So those sorts of things have really been nice, as well as just access to the galleries and museums all over the world that I can show to the kids. I can access those websites. I can take them on a tour of the Louvre, right? I mean, those are amazing innovations that are available to us that weren't 20 years ago when I began.
So I'm reminded of everything I missed out on. Shoot.
You can enroll.
I'll just start over.
Start over.
I have another question from the audience, and these are not necessarily just organically flowing with what we're talking about, but a good point. We have a panel of four white women, and we definitely noticed at the beginning it was a girl power moment. But how do you, in the classroom and perhaps with innovation, address diversity? I know this is an area of specialty that you were educated in. How do you address diversity, and particularly at this moment, we'll talk about color, in your classroom, and how do you integrate innovation?
I think it's interesting not to assume, because I'm a Hispanic, is my background. For us, Coleman is very diverse, and really, we just embrace the diversity. We're also a Title I, so we have extreme poverty, a little bit middle class, and then just upper middle class. We have a diversity festival that we have, so we bring in our families. We have a lot of family engagement evenings where we come in, and we want to know about everybody's culture. It can be difficult to talk about the hard subjects, but we don't shy away from it in our building, and I certainly don't shy away from it in my classroom. I want to know how you feel. I want to know your opinion. What I tell my students is you just have to be respectful. We can always disagree, but it is how we disagree that makes the difference. And so it's okay to talk about color and the things that are going on in the world and the different cultures. And so at least for me, I embrace that. I want to know what you're doing. Well, what does that festival mean? My Hispanic students, they dance in a parade. It's not advertised in the Eagle about this huge religious parade that happens in Wichita every year. And so some of my colleagues and I went, and we were just shocked. I was like, I read the paper every day. I did not see this in here. How did we miss this? And it was talking to my students. So I don't say there's not problems, but we just truly, I try to embrace it all. I mean, talk to me about it. I want to know more. So
that's one thing we definitely celebrate. I mean, the differences that we have as far as all across the board, and it's fascinating. In fact, today in this third year class, it was one of the things, it came up, they started saying, look at the difference of us all around. And it was fascinating because they go, you know, your color is a little browner than my color. And it was really fun. And we were talking about what a joy it was to see the differences, and that didn't matter, that we were all wonderful human beings that were brought into on this planet, and that we enjoy life. And you know, so it's one of those things that, you know, I think is one of the real pluses that we have, because we have such a diverse families that we have too, and you know, the different celebrations that are there, you know, for not only, you know, religions but beliefs and cultures, and they come and they go to you know, different festivals or different things, and they come back and they celebrate. We bring in the dancers to our school. We have it where they come in, and there's just a real joy of knowing the differences, and so, you know, for us, it is a blessing. You know, we love that part.
And sometimes I think it's more of an adult issue, mm-hmm. and not necessarily a child issue. I do not see the conflict with color or culture in my science classroom than I see more of it being an adult issue. Like, the kids seem very accepting. We have some students in our building that are extremely challenged mentally. They're not able to control their outbursts at times. And one of the students had a huge meltdown outside my classroom. My eighth grade AVID students were very considerate of that difference. We can call it a cultural difference. They didn't respond at all to the student's meltdown, screaming, cussing, yelling. They had empathy for that student. And so I feel like sometimes as adults, we bring that there, and my students seem okay. I've not really seen a clash or questioning. It's almost, it's an acceptance.
I think one of the factors at Northfield is that we don't start till sixth grade, grades 6 through 12. A lot of us are homeschoolers, and I called it an exhausted homeschooler school at the very beginning. But I think that the homeschool movement, back to this idea of being human, that has hit the spectrum. It has hit everybody. Everybody has a way to go be themselves, to interact with anything they want to. Again, this freedom of choice is what we are really wanting. At Northfield, 65% of us are on scholarship. And I spend a lot of time raising money, but we also have one day a week. It's called Work Wednesday. I was there today. We go into community gardens. We go into the Masonic Home, which is next door to us. Friends University has this program called Friendship Fields, where they take mentally and physically challenged kids who have graduated from high school, and they're in college, and we're running a coffee shop with them. We are able, because of our size again, and because of our orientation towards the person, as opposed to, you know, what is our curriculum? Remember, you carry your faculty and you have your curriculum in creation. Just by virtue of our orientation to openness, choice, the world itself, we have every ethnicity that is represented in Wichita. I consider myself a Viking, you know, I'm a Scandinavian person.
So, that absolutely fits, actually.
Yeah, let's don't exclude any Vikings. But I think, again, what we're all saying is we've made this an issue. Mm-hmm. And it's not the issue. Birds of a feather flock together, there's no question. But in the real world, they don't. And we want, all as educators, we know that's where these kids are headed. And we want to simulate that as much as we can by giving them choice, expectations in how we call them an artist, a scientist, an explorer, a scholar. I think we're just all yelling, let us free.
Mm-hmm. And I think it goes even deeper than that, instilling hope in these students.
Wow.
To make them believe that the world is not such a terrible place and that you as an individual can make a difference. That sounds very cheesy, but it's true. A lot of them don't feel like they are important, or they come from homes that they are the adult in the home. And so when they come in these four walls, they forget that they're safe, they matter, and they can just be a kid. And so I think part of the creative.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And now it's there's a lot of unknowns. And so, you know, I ask them, you know, are you willing to be able to teach your children how to be thinkers, how to solve problems, how to that is such to me a crucial part. So if they're open to those things, I think, you know, then they have an opening to the teaching field. But I think there are a lot of unknowns anymore in teaching.
There's a lot of discussion right now that the formula we have, or the systems that we have, including Northfield, because we have all the buzzers, bells, ACTs, you know, we send out grades six times a year. But I think we're all starting to wonder why a system that was basically useful in 1890, as the industrial age was bringing forward Detroit and, you know, the automation and the line of passing, you know, the conveyor belt, why we are still using that when the tools that we have, like the computer, have so decentralized everything. And I think that there is a lot of thought being put into that. And it still is that guy in Los Angeles, you know, saying, just make it smaller. Make it smaller. Steve Jobs said, this computer is not going to work unless it's like part of their body. It's not going to work. And so I think he has showed us that, yes, those things that become that connected to us are the things that are going to work. So we have some rethinking to do. That's why we're all here tonight. We're thinking.
Yeah. I guess, you know, it's sort of winding up here. We normally would ask people on our panels at the end of an Engage ICT, okay, what next? Right. And I mean, we've kind of been talking about what's next or what's going on. I wonder if we could flip it a little bit and kind of ask, what do you need from us as the community around your community, as people invested in, of course, kids growing up, our kids are growing up with you. What do you need from us to do what you want to do? And why don't we start here, and we'll just assembly line this question right down all the way to the other end.
Well, one thing I think is just the celebration of differences of education. I think that's a very important part. I think this format is really wonderful for that part. You know, I know with the Montessori school, there are so many people that have no idea about it, and it's just like this beautiful secret under this basket, and that we're taking the lid off and seeing this great big light that's glowing. And I think, to me, that is one of the most important parts, to see the differences of education and be able to celebrate those differences.
I think being a classroom teacher, and have been for so many years, I feel like I personally would need that support. Please don't think that my job is 9 months of the calendar year and I get 3 months off, because that's not the case. I have a trunk full of things that, because I want to stay 10 steps ahead of my students, I make sure that I'm very well planned, and it's kind of a joke in my building that I have to touch everything before I leave the classroom to make sure it's ready. But it's not. I feel like good teachers that truly have a passion for what they're doing, it's a 24/7 thing. You're always thinking about, how can I make what I'm doing right now a learning experience for my avid kids? What can I do for my STEM kids 10th hour that I could get them in here with the technology to have them explore and see what the world is like behind a microphone in a studio? So I'm always thinking what I can do to engage my students, to keep them wanting to become lifelong learners. So I just feel like, please understand, it's not a 9 month, you get 3 months off. It's so much more than that. You invest your whole self with these students. I can't turn off and step away from my job at the end of the day. I go in an hour and a half before school starts. I usually stay an hour and a half after, and that's not including what I take home to do for my kids when I get home. And my family is a big part of it. They're always at my school. My kids know my husband. They saw my daughter grow up. They keep asking me, what college is she going to? Is she still swimming? So they're heavily involved in what I do. So it doesn't stop. We're always thinking. We are always on, and we invest so much of ourselves, our emotion, our feelings into these kids, and they know that. But that's what I would need personally, is that support, to not think, oh, she has this time off, and no, I really don't. So that's what I would need personally.
Well, as Northfield, I just have to say, come and see. I want people to come. I want you to come. My husband's from Chattanooga, Tennessee, and it's y'all come. Just come. I want you to come. Our students pamphleted the neighborhood. We're in the Delano neighborhood. We're in one of the most high dropout rates, and our students pamphleted and just said, come see us. Come talk to us.
I remember my mom telling me that when she was a kid, she was so thrilled one summer because a new teacher had moved in next door. And it was like Mick Jagger had moved in next door. And then somewhere along the way, there's been sort of a shift and a change in how educators are seen, and so I think my hope from the community is just celebrate teachers again, see them in the light that they should be.
You know, the question at the beginning, the simple question was, how are we going to develop lifelong learners? And I heard a lot of that going on here. I don't think there's still so much to figure out. I think y'all just need to talk to people more. Your stories are pretty spectacular. Zach has had the opportunity to experience all of you in some way, and this is beautiful. I come from a public school in a suburb of Houston, and it was many years ago, and it was just nothing like this. The thoughtfulness is spectacular. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think we're good. you know, we'll keep our doors open for another 10 or 15 minutes. If you all want to just kind of hang out, you can meet the panelists here and ask them some questions. And we really appreciate all of you coming out and engaging with this topic. And I think we're having another one next month.
Well, I just realized we want to thank...
Oh, and we do.
We want to thank a couple of folks for, let's see, we have Whole Foods.
Whole Foods provided some of the nosh.
Help us finish it.
Yeah.
The killer coriander.
Hopping Gnome provided some really tasty beer. You know about it. All right. And of course, we want to thank
Kansas.
Volunteer Kansas for sponsoring the series of Engage ICT. Yeah. And that's been a really important contribution as well. So thank you to everyone for making this happen.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for joining us for Engage ICT Democracy on Tap. Find more podcasts and videos at engageict.org. This event was hosted and recorded at KMUW in Wichita. Our engineers are John Cyphers and Torin Anderson. The event hosts were Deborah Frazier and myself. For KMUW, this is Zach Gingrich-Gaylord.